Please be seated.
Right, Ms. Baker Galloway. Good morning.
Morning.
So I just want to start first by looking at your objectives, and the new objective in particular, 10A12.
Yes.
In sort of a more high-level point of view, what I'm taking from that objective is that you see a place in this plan change for an environmental objective to be expressed, not just a process-related objective.
Yes, as it relates to that slightly longer-term pathway for some catchments.
The reference in your objective, in the second last line, you do refer to halting or reversing degradation of an FMU. Do you agree that that part of the objective would apply to any decision made under the PC7 framework? So even the controlled activity pathway should have the objective of halting or reversing degradation?
My interpretation of the pathway for the controlled is to put a line in the sand now effectively and just roll over for 6 years, but I think from the evidence we've heard is that that may not halt degradation because there is a risk for some of those threatened species that just stopping now may result in further degradation in that 6 years.
Yeah, okay. Have you had a chance to read Mr. Farrell's supplementary evidence?
I realise that that's the one. I don't think I have read a supplementary. I've read his full one. But
okay. If I could get Madam Registrar to find that for you. So it's dated 24 March. Sorry? Oh, yes, it's got 23 March on the cover. Yeah, that's right. We've got success.
Not yet, no.
Oh, sorry. Apologies, ma'am. I should have prearranged this.
You say have a copy.
Thank you. So, in the appendix, you'll find Mr. Farrell's redrafted objective 10A11.
Yes.
Just let you read that.
Yes.
So as you'll see, rather than, if you like, picking and choosing particular values that Mr. Moore took you through and excluding other values, if you like, you'll see that Mr. Farrell's objective tries to stay at the level of the NPS objective 2.1A, the top priority for Te Mana o Te Wai. So it focuses on protecting the health and well-being of water bodies from further adverse effects from water abstraction activities. So it's a holding of the line objective. Do you agree with that interpretation?
Yes. Though the only point I note on that is that we may yet see in the next year or so some further change for some applicants, particularly where there has been conversion to spray. I know of one applicant in particular in just the last season. So from the time that this was decided, there still may be further decline on the odd one. I accept that probably that's not all of them.
But if you were to draft a more generic environmental objective, this expresses it at that general level, doesn't it?
Yes,
the, the aim of this plan change is to stop further degradation at the very least, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Now, with Mr. Moore, you agreed that when assessing effects of new consents, one of the points of comparison is the water body in the absence of consented abstractions and
yes.
consented activities. And do you agree that that assessment is relevant not just for a Section 104 assessment for a consent, it would also be relevant when assessing how to give effect to the National Policy Statement?
Yes.
And in particular, you'd agree that to assess the first priority of Te Mana o Te Wai, how to protect the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems, we need to have that understanding of what that water body would have supported or could support if it was restored to an abstraction-free state.
Yes, I think there is some discussion around that baseline still needing to account for if we're looking at an individual consent, the other consents, such as, for example, the impact like the Clyde Dam has on, you know, it's a consented take. If we're looking just at takes, say, in the Minnehirakea, there is an impact of that authorised consent on the actual baseline environment.
Of the structures of the Clyde Dam?
Yes, yeah.
But they also have a finite term.
They do,
yeah.
Yes.
You referred to the set of consents that you've applied for recently, that you've helped people apply for recently. Were any of those considered under the non-complying pathway?
Every single one has been.
Every single one has been?
Even for 6 years.
Right. So still on Mr. Farrell's evidence, if you go down to new policy 10A24.
Yep.
I'll let you read that and the table that follows it.
Yes.
So just to give you the context, originally the table was proposed in reliance on Dr. Hayes' evidence, aimed to set a presumptive set of thresholds in relation to naturalised MALF that would help interpret the words no more than minor that were originally in the policy, so you're familiar with
yes.
that? Yep. And then with the suggested redrafting from Mr. De Pelsmaker and the removal of that word, which Fish and Game and Mr. Farrell support, the suggestion is now that you could use those presumptive thresholds for when the no more than minor test is used either for notification or the alternative limb for non-complying activity. So in your experience, having an objective signpost to when it's presumed that effects are no more than minor, unless comprehensive assessments otherwise establish it, is that of any assistance in your role based on your experience with applicants?
No. And particularly, well, for those ones that may be seeking a longer term, then yes. But for those that are still seeking a six-year term, then no, because at this point in time, one of the key drivers for why they are considered non-complying under the notified plan relates to the schedule and the assessments under that schedule. And I don't think that an assessment such as this could be undertaken without significant science and hydrological work, as has been pointed out in that objective. And that requires a lot of time and money invested for what is ultimately a six-year term still being sought, which is intended to still be reflecting the intent of PC7 of rolling over, putting a line in the sand, but there was purely been issues with the notified version that meant that they were non-complying. And I think for the six-year terms that we have recently applied for, under the version of the controlled activity that is now being put forward, the majority of those would be controlled.
Right. So let's assume then that the majority of those that by accident previously fell into the non-complying category, that they now have a controlled route for an application that was substantively non-complying. Mm-hmm. Do you see assistance and certainty in not having to have a debate with the Regional Council about whether or not an application should be notified for starters?
Yes, although I come back to it only probably being beneficial for those that are seeking that longer term under that non-complying, not the shorter term. And in a sense, this sort of this would form part of any scientist assessment of what a recommended minimum flow would be. But not being a scientist, I couldn't tell you the exact details around this and whether that's appropriate or not.
No, that's okay. Yeah. I don't want you to comment on that. Thank you, ma'am. No further questions.
Ms. Irving for ORUG.
Yeah, I just have a couple of brief questions, Your Honour. Ms. Perkins, do you have a copy of the Schedule 10A4 technical conference statement available to you?
I've got the planners one, but I don't have the primary sector one.
Can we have that, please, Madam Registrar?
Sorry, I do have a copy at home, but it didn't make it into the folder. Oh, no, the planners won't be primary sector. Yes, I've got that one.
Thank you. I'm just wanting to clarify, I suppose, the source of the changes that Mr. Moore discussed with you regarding the period of time or the dates for the monitoring data that would be assessed to calculate the take rates and volumes.
Yep.
Now, can you please have a look at paragraph 19 of the primary sector joint witness statement?
Yes.
Can you read that, please?
All witnesses consider every full year, 1st of July to 30th of June the following year, of available verified water meter data should be used.
And if we look at the updated set of provisions that were attached to the planning conference statement,
yes,
in particular the controlled activity rule, A31.1, Romans 4 and 6.
Yes.
Is it your understanding that the changes in those two provisions reflect the agreement reached in the technical joint witness statement?
Yes, that was the intention behind those changes.
And if we go to the planner's statement,
yes.
I'm just trying to find the.
Yeah.
You're right.
Well, I know if you let me finish, Philip, I think I'll round out the questioning just as a point of clarification.
Well, you put a question to the witness, which indicated that all witnesses had agreed with that, whereas that's not what the joint witness statement says.
The technical
yes.
one? I think paragraph 19 says that.
I'll look at paragraph 22.
I'll just read it.
Sorry, which one am I looking at? The technical conference.
Oh,
paragraph 22.
Sure, but there were three technical
conferences. Oh, sorry, the primary sector one. Yes.
Well, in that case, there were four technical conferences, yes, because the planners also had As a planner, I think planners are technical too, in a different kind of way, perhaps.
Yeah, so paragraph 22, would you like me to read that for the court's report?
No, I just want to read it to myself, and I'll read all four paragraphs 19 to 22. I think what Mr. Moore's objection is that I think it's Mr. Wilson is saying all witnesses are considered every full year, but Mr. Wilson's got doubt as to whether or not including the records post June 2020 could influence behaviour of water users.
Yes.
So it's more nuanced than just simply saying all users.
Yeah. Yes, and my next question was going to be that is effectively what's picked up in the planners' conference, where there's set out in paragraphs 13 to 19 the differences on that particular issue.
Can I ask the question?
So is it your, I suppose if we go to paragraphs 13 through 19 of the planners' conference,
yes,
there were differences that are recorded there about whether or not that agreement at paragraph 19 should be pulled across from a planning perspective.
Yes, there was different views on that.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Kill. Before we get to the court's questions, you have this chance to ask yourself whether there's any need to, just picking up on any questions asked by any of the three lawyers, whether there's any matter that you feel ought to be clarified any matter that you think ought to be clarified or where perhaps you weren't given a full opportunity to give a full response. And so this is your chance now, and then the court will ask you some questions.
I think I'm okay with where I got to with those.
Okay, that's good. All right, I'm going to hand you over to Commissioner Edmonds.
Sure.
Morning. So I've just got a couple of matters I want to explore, that's sure. all. And so I'd like you to turn to the controlled activity rule.
And the version that was sent through last night?
Yes, yep. in the version that you sent through. And I'm looking at Roman 4
yes.
and really Roman 6, which say the same thing, but one's in relation to volume and the other's in relation to the rate of take. Yes. But there's a similar principle applying. So my understanding is that in terms of the metering regulations, they came in 2010.
I can't recall the exact date, but it sounds about right.
Yes, I think that's stated in one of these entry conditions somewhere, isn't it? Yes, it's actually in,
oh, yes, it is. Seven, yeah, in the
it's
RDA.
In Roman yeah. 7, so it talks about
yes, it is.
The regulations there. So if you think then that you may be able to go back to the 2010 situation. And then you think about what this looked like, this four and six, the little Roman ones.
Mm-hmm.
There was previously a period 1 July 2015 through to 30 June 2020.
Yes.
And that's been struck out.
Mm-hmm.
And it just says for which water meter data is available.
Yes.
So my question to you is, so you had 2015,
mm-hmm.
that was a very particular date. We've had quite a lot of evidence about the amount of more efficient irrigation that's been going on. Some of that presumably would date 2015, would it?
I would be guessing, but I think that's probably true, yes.
True. So quite a lot of that flood irrigation and the border diking irrigation, still some around, we've heard that,
yes.
But quite a lot of it has gone now, and you have more efficient the K-lines and then the pivot irrigation.
Yes.
Systems now and other efficient methods of doing things,
yes.
Including storage. So I guess my question to you is, why wouldn't you stick with the 2015 date? Why do you need to open it up to earlier periods?
Sure. I think this was addressed by Ms. Bright as well, but from my understanding from discussions with her and from her evidence is that the water meter data that is available prior to 2015 is still valuable data as well. It won't always be the case that that was just relating to flood irrigation at that time. So I think it still needs to be considered, because part of my understanding from the hydrologist's concerns is that the 2015 to 2020 limit may not capture all climatological years that might apply in terms of dry or wet seasons. So that might then be adversely or unfairly impacting on an applicant who might have completely valid data from 2014 that might better reflect, say, a year in which they irrigated more, but that was not necessarily because of flood irrigation, that it's higher volumes. I don't think you could say clearly one way or the other that it's only because if the data from those years before 2015 was higher in volume or rate than the data from 2015 to 2020, I don't think you could categorically say that that was just because it was flood irrigation happening. That may be the case for some applicants, potentially, but it may not be the case for everyone. Does that answer your question?
Well, it does in one way, but it doesn't in another, because if you've got a completely different pattern of use that's been going on post making all those improvements, mm-hmm. in the efficiency of your irrigation, why would you be going right back to get the highest figure, the maximum figure that you can work to, right back to a period that predates all those improvements?
Well, I think the risk is that even though you've made those changes with irrigation, the 2015 to 2020 years may still not have accurately reflected the most that you may need under that system or may have historically taken, even if you'd put the spray in at a different season. I just don't think you can clearly work out what the climate... You'd have to go back and look at individual climate data in each year and compare it to what you've used to work out if, even under spray, you might have taken more historically prior to 2015.
So is there anything in the matter that control is reserved to that's going to allow the decision maker to look into the kinds of issues that we're just talking about now?
Not explicitly, no. There is still a limit to within the limits of a matter within the limits of historical use. So there is still some interrogation of the data required and provided for within that matter. So it is still a matter of control with regards to the actual volume and rate that gets placed on the consent.
Say it again.
So
the proposition is your period of data includes a time at which inefficient or less efficient irrigation systems were being employed on farm and consequently higher volumes and rates of take. So that's the data that you have captured.
Mm-hmm.
How does that then get filtered out, if I could put it that way, because it no longer represents the current irrigation system?
It doesn't explicitly get filtered out.
Should it be?
No, I don't think it should necessarily be, because the evidence that I've heard from the hydrologists are that period of time of 2015 to 2020 still might not accurately reflect the historical use that may have been, that is required and has been used.
I'm not bothered by any particular time frame or years. What I think our interest is in the shift in efficiencies in irrigation systems. How is that captured or thought about in the controlled activity?
It's not.
Should it be?
Then you have to look at efficiency of use calculations that then you couldn't apply it to every situation, because there will be some that are still flood irrigating, and it wouldn't be fair to impose an efficiency of use upgrade requirement for a 6-year controlled activity pathway.
Yes, I understand that. But just say they were flood irrigating, to use the totally out there example of an inefficient system, and have now moved to a lateral, more efficient. What do you do? Do you allow them to say, well, my historical use is based on flood irrigation?
I absolutely see the point. I don't know how many this would apply to. I'd have to talk to the hydrologist about which situations have shown that data prior to 2015 is a lot higher than post that time. So I think it is a situational examination required as to whether that actually is a real risk in this situation?
I don't know. I mean, most of your evidence, or a lot of the evidence that we've received, is that there's been substantial investment to improve the efficiencies of irrigation systems. So on your own evidence, that would apply to most people that you've got knowledge of.
Yes, there has been investment by, I think, most clients that I have knowledge of, to some extent, whether it's their full property or some of their property, there has been investment to improve things, yes, in light of knowing that the renewal process was coming up.
With that in mind, how do you capture the historic use? That's really what we're interested in.
Well, perhaps answer that question, then I have another question.
Sure. The only way you can include it would be if there was an additional requirement to outline details of your system and
your current irrigation system
and any changes they've made. But then you'd also have to reflect on, well, that maybe only happened in 2017. And so it would have to more fall, I think, under the RDA pathway rather than the... But then at the same time, that maximum through the schedule is for this controlled. So there would have to be another matter of control to address that, if that needed to be addressed. And I don't know how much of a concern that is, to know whether I think it should be included and the effort goes into adding an additional matter. But I think in the essence of keeping this as simple as possible for a 6-year rollover, knowing that at the end of 6 years, the full efficiency and what water is needed scenario will be addressed through the new land and water plan permits. So I think I still come back to the intent of the plan change to be as simple as possible. And the moment you start adding in, then they need to look at when systems changed, what years, have they been wet years, have they been dry years, adds another layer of complexity.
So a follow-up question is you have struck out three, which was the total land area under irrigation and the maximum area irrigated period, the 1st of September 2017 to 18 March 2020. Now, that perhaps was a bit more of a safeguard that, in fact, any efficiency measures that had been undertaken might in some way be locked in, because it's an entry condition, or would be locked in.
Yes, I accept that.
So if you were to put that back in, would that deal with some of the matters that we've just been talking about in terms of...
Yes, it probably would, because you couldn't, even with a spray system, if that's in place, you couldn't... No farmer's going to go and flood their property with their spray system. The irrigation is designed to be purposeful for the pasture or crop that you're growing. You're not going to put far more water on than is needed, particularly if you're earlier in a season. You don't want to use your annual volume up too early and then have nothing left if autumn becomes dry, much like it has been. So that would provide a backstop to not using that historic but maybe a flood irrigation volume over any more area.
Okay, thank you. So I guess that's the controlled activity rule, but if we could just go back to the policy, A2, R1, and we've got D. And so now we've got this word historical that's come in here. So that's not defined in any way, is it?
No, there is no specific definition of it, no. It came through the planner's joint witness statement. It's not meaning anything different than actual. It was just a reflection of the fact that in the RDA pathway, it may not be solely water meter records that you have the actual point in time, day, timestamp of that water taken on that day. And if there are other methods used, one that comes to mind that we discussed quite a bit at that conferencing was the use of something like synthetic records for hydroelectricity generation. So that effectively does go back and show what water was going past the intakes on those dates, but it's not an actual record through a water meter. So the use of historical instead of actual reflected that it is reflecting the historical use, but it's not through an actual water meter record that you could hold up.
So that term historical use, that's come over, for example, in the matters of control, hasn't it? So do you think there might be a lack of clarity with that term? Could that potentially arise, result in an argument subsequently? Do you think that it's clear?
I think all the planners were fairly clear on the use of historical and what it meant, in the sense that it was reflecting what has actually been taken, you know, whatever method is used to demonstrate that. It wasn't purporting to suggest that it would be future or demand-based assessments of what you might need. It was... I don't think historical would cover that.
So you don't think there's a need to define it?
No, I don't.
So I just want to make sure that I'm clear about the restricted discretionary activity. So we've had this discussion about the controlled activity conditions, 1V and V1. But I'm just having a look at the RD, the A one that you've got here. So you haven't suggested that little 3, which was the one about the area under irrigation over a certain time period, you haven't suggested that be struck out for the RD. That's still there in A as a pre-entry.
It's probably just an issue last night as I pulled over the RD rule from the planner's joint witness statement, which we didn't address the likes of whether 3 should stay in or out as part of that conferencing, because that wasn't related to the schedule.
But in the light of the discussion that we had on the controlled activity, wouldn't it be logical, if you were following that line
would,
of direction, that the 3 should stay?
Yes, in the line of irrigation areas.
Condition.
Yep.
So what kinds of activities would you envisage coming in terms of this RD rule?
The intention behind that was really that originally, as it was drafted, it was only capturing those that had an issue with their data, like a technical issue or missing data. And a lot of our discussion was around the fact that that may not capture everyone. So it may not capture someone who's got a very good data record for 3 years. There's no missing data. There's no technical issues with that data. But it only captures the last 3 years, and that's not reflective of historic use. They might have manual records and other information reflecting what they took prior to that point in time. And so this would allow for those people, or those that might only have 1 year of record, to actually include additional data with their application to demonstrate what their historical use has been, so that it actually is representative of their historical use and not just 1 or 2 years of water meter.
So what's then the limitation on any activity coming under the RD category?
Well, I think the incentive is still there to follow a controlled path with a guaranteed grant. The RD path doesn't have that same certainty for an applicant, and if they're just going, oh, I can just try and use something else for an extra 1 or 2 litres a second, there's not enough incentive, I don't think, in the RD path when you're still having to provide a lot more information at more cost and you've still got a six-year term. The incentive is still there for the controlled activity pathway where the data is representative that you have.
But is this pathway, though, this would be attractive to someone who thinks they can make a case for a greater historical use, that is available to them,
but there is still the discretion for the council to look at that data and assess it, and they don't have to grant a consent on that basis. There is still the discretion for the council officers to disagree with what has been put forward by an applicant.
But when you look at the matters that the discretion is restricted to, that they're quite narrow. They're just about that, really, aren't they?
They are, and that's the only exception.
Water meter data and other relevant methods and data. And I think there has been other evidence and questions about what that might mean.
Yes.
I think you asked about that. I'm sorry, I can't recall.
I think it might have been Ms. Bright that was
Ms. Bright,
asked about that. I can't recall.
Right. No, that's right. So I think that was quite thoroughly explored.
Yes.
So the council officers are going to have a fairly, I don't know, what sort of discretion do you think they're going to have in terms of A?
I think it will still come down to their audit of the data and other relevant methods or data that's put forward. At the current point in time, there is still robust debate between applicants and consultants and the council with regards to analysis of water meter data, and there always has been even before PC7 was introduced. So I think that it will still come down to the same method, and if there is a significant disagreement, it may be that things progress to a hearing between council and the applicant if an agreement can't be reached on that and an applicant doesn't agree with proposed draft conditions that may come from council. So they still have full discretion over an audit and review of that data, much like any consent application. There's a full audit of the information provided.
Sure, but they won't be able to get into efficiency, presumably.
No, this isn't intended to cover what is an efficient use.
And so what sort of time period could this data go back to? Just going back to those discussions we were having about inefficient border diking and flood irrigation, what would be your understanding on that?
There is no limit where it would go back to, but it would come down to an applicant having to have a reasonable record of their historic use in some form that they can talk to what has been historically taken. I think from discussions at the planners conferencing the likes of hydroelectricity that can has the tools and systems to generate synthetic flow records, for example, they might be able to go back further than an applicant who's been irrigating could, in terms of having a reasonable record of historic use.
So the AA, the community water supplies, so that one,
mm-hmm.
it talks about existing water permit volume and rate limits. So what do you understand by that term, existing water permit volume and rate limits?
So the intention here was that A still applies to community water supplies, so it still has to be historic use, but we recognise that the schedule only looks at historic use, and in order to provide for some population growth requirements, but it would that an additional volume potentially on top of what has historically been taken could be provided for here, but that it still had to be no more than the existing water permit limits. So, for example, say your consent limit is 50 litres a second. Historically, you've taken 40, but as a community supply, you know your projected growth might mean you need to take 44. So you're still within your consent limits, but there is an ability to allow for some growth. But potentially Mr. Toos and the TAs are more suited to answer that. But from a planning perspective, that's where we came to with the drafting of that.
Yes, I was asking from that perspective, but I'll leave exploring that a little further and we'll see him soon. Thank you.
Okay. Oh dear, there goes me. I haven't got many questions. As you've indicated yesterday, you've got no experience with rights, priority and deemed permits, so that's okay. Just turning to your proposed policy 10A 2.3 and matter noted at Roman numeral 6, and here we've got an allocation that is the lesser of the rate and volume assessed using the methodology in the schedule or alternatively an efficient use of water. And you said that could be amended to say using the Aqualink guidelines an efficient volume of water. I thought that the Aqualink guidelines could also be used to determine what is a reasonable volume of demand, excluding or setting to one side whether the system's efficient or not. So, for example, if I was a border diker and I had poor records, if I was using K-line with poor records, I could go to that Aqualink guideline and that would tell me what would be a reasonable demand for my farm. And you're agreeing with that?
Yes, I'm agreeing with that.
Okay. And so the issue here, is it one of efficiency or is it one of, I thought the issue here is what to do if you haven't got good records or good data, good records for your data. The issue with Aqualink is not efficiency of use, but it's actually demand, isn't it? Or is that what you're meant to be covering off in the RDA?
So where it's talked about here for this discretionary pathway, Aqualink gives you an estimate of demand, but it's on the assumption that it's an efficient irrigation system.
So it can't produce demand?
For flood irrigation.
For flood irrigation.
No, it could not.
Or for border diking?
No.
What about K-line?
It's for a spray system.
It's for a spray system only.
Oh. For a spray system only for Aqualink, or potentially there's like a dripper process for trees. I'm not entirely sure on that, but I know it's on the demand on the assumption that the system is efficient, and there is a specific percentage efficiency included in those guidelines. I can't recall what that is.
Okay, so many irrigation systems, in fact, would be excluded.
Yes, yep. The inefficient ones that we would typically refer to as inefficient, anything that's got that sort of surface application via flood or contour or border dike, they would not be accounted for within the Aqualink demand.
That's good to know. Now, the second question I had relating to your same draft policy, and in particular Roman numeral 7, Mr. Moore's already asked you about what is required for substantial investment, and you said case by case, and I think he reflected back that there would be, the individual's tolerance for investment or for accruing of debt might vary, and I think you acknowledge that that would also be true. My question is more to do with the phrase require substantial investment, and I understand from that phrase require that this is investment in the future, so it's not already investment which has been made.
Yes.
Okay. And you're proposing that this, well, are you proposing that this future investment be for securing items 1 and 2 of the same policy?
Yes.
So it's not...
It's not sitting on its own in the sense of someone just wanting to have investment that means they could come under this policy. It's all tied back to 1 and 2.
Securing those two. Okay. And so with that in mind, I read over your additional statement which you made yesterday on behalf of several farmers. I couldn't see how they would themselves avail themselves of this discretionary policy because each of those farmers, by and large, have made substantial investment, or I think in the case of the hydro, wasn't proposing substantial investment, was proposing just a rollover of the consent. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And so for all of those farmers that you note in your opening representation on behalf of LandPro and others, they're all going to be 6-year consents?
The majority of those probably wouldn't fall within that discretionary pathway. I think Mr. Naylor is only one that might do. But potentially, actually, on the reading of that, possibly not.
Okay.
More that it falls within the wider catchment and there's other people. Yeah, it is.
It's not your client.
No, Mr. Naylor is my client.
No. None of these people take advantage of what you've proposed here.
No, they haven't.
No, okay.
Not directly.
All right. So who does?
I would imagine that the majority of the applicants that can take advantage of this would be those that have had deemed permits, because there's a big number altogether in specific catchments. It would be those falling within the Manahirakea, the Cadrona and the Arrow primarily.
Sorry.
And probably some of the Tairi, but I don't know the Tairi well enough to be able to...
But you do know Manahirakea, and you do know Cadrona, and you do know Arrow. And correct?
Not the Arrow so much, but Cadrona and Manahirakea.
Okay, you know them sufficiently to know that they could bring themselves under your drafted policy.
Not to the level of detail that every single one in that group would, and I guess that's part of the drafting, is that if changes are required to 80% that fall within that subcatchment of the applicants, and maybe 20% are part of the whole group, but they have already made infrastructure upgrades, on reading that now, there is concern about whether they could then still be part of that.
And
yes, I accept that now, thinking about that.
Okay.
There is some difficulty with that.
There is some difficulty. And that's with Manahirakea and Cadrona, or just one or other, or you can't say?
Probably both. Probably both.
Because you have a, within those groups, you have a population, if you like, who've already made that substantial investment. So therefore, policy wouldn't apply to them.
The 7 wouldn't, but the rest probably still would.
Yeah. I don't understand that because... I look at the words and.
Yes.
It's a conjunctive. You actually have to qualify.
Yes.
It's future investment. They've already made it. They're out.
Yes.
And so for them, just a 6-year consent.
But then the difficulty is you wouldn't achieve the benefits that could be achieved through some of these subcatchments with all of those parties being on board because there is difficulty there. They couldn't necessarily all be on board with that. Although they have made the investment, whether that's sufficient, depending on what the outcome is of this, and whether they have to make more, I couldn't say.
And so was this policy drafted with those two catchments in mind, Cadrona and Manahirakea?
Those were two of the priority catchments that were in mind that are experiencing those concerns with regards to threatened species and degradation.
Mm. And I think it may have been in relation to hydro. Unfortunately, I can't locate my... notepad. But in relation to hydro, and in response to a question from Mr. Moore, the greater risk, I thought it was hydro, but it might not have been, the greater risk for companies seeking replacement consents where they're involved in hydro was not PC7, but was a future plan to come, the future land and water plan. Do you recall saying something to that effect?
I can't recall it.
But is that correct? The greater level of uncertainty and therefore risk going forward is not this plan, but it's actually a future plan.
Yes, potentially. And I think the other part of the risk that comes with some of those hydro is if they're linked to large dams that then are requiring a lot of investment on that six-year term. So I think sometimes it comes with those two aspects combined rather than just sitting on their own.
And if that was true for hydro, is it also true for primary sector?
Yes.
And is that risk to do with what the future regional plan, land and water plan, might say about over-allocation?
Yes.
And so in seeking a 15-year consent, which is what you now propose, is that to, in some way, future-proof the take and use of water?
No, I don't think it is in any way. I think the land and water plan will still come in and will still set its limits, and consents will either be a short term now and apply within 6 years under that, or within 15 years either get to the end of that 15 and apply under that new plan, or be reviewed in respect of allocation and flow limits, for example, in that time frame. So no, I don't think it's a future proofing that. It's more providing for the duration needed to be able to secure investment to make those changes and upgrades that are required to protect those critical ecosystems with threatened species and degradation occurring. And I think that's where the term comes in, is that 6 years doesn't allow for that level of investment to undertake those changes to the systems and to reflect those minimum flows that may be required there.
I thought you'd agreed with Mr. Moore that it was unlikely that the Regional Council would review every permit.
Yeah, I don't think that they will review every permit, and it may just depend on which catchments and
is that
which
because
concerns.
Of the sheer volume of permits to be reviewed and the depth and capacity of consents officers that would be required to be engaged, or external consultancies required to be engaged to undertake that task throughout Otago?
Probably both, and I think it's important to point out here as well that it wouldn't be only consents granted under PC7 that are part of that review process. I think, as the council has pointed out, there is a large number of consents across Otago for water that don't expire in this time frame, and they also would form part of the need to whether or not they need to be reviewed. And I think Ms. Dicey mentioned the Tairi, which has a large number, a large percentage of its allocation for 35-year consents.
Mm-hmm.
So that obviously is not part of the PC7 process, but are also consents that may then need to be reviewed.
And I understand, with that in mind, your answer is unlikely that the Regional Council would engage in a review exercise across the region.
I don't think there would be one across the region. There may be catchment-specific ones where it's more critical. But I couldn't say without knowing what the land and water plan outcome is and which catchments there would need to be substantial change in, and the level of time required, I couldn't say on behalf of the council what that would be.
And so what do you think would inform what catchments there may be the need for substantial change?
I think it would depend on what the limits are that come through the new land and water plan compared to what is on existing permits, and what is occurring in the environment at the time is to, just as putting a number out there, say the minimum flow that comes through the land and water plan is 500 litres a second, but all the current consents are bringing everything down to 100, that might signal a significant need to make some change straight away.
And moving in the opposite direction of that review would be considerations of viability, wouldn't it, as a matter that the council would have to consider on a review?
Yes.
That viability is linked, is it not, to efficiency of use?
Yes, but I don't think it limits the ability to remove some allocation or limit on that consent in terms of their rate of take or volume of take.
So my proposition to you is, if I am a farmer with substantial new investment in irrigation systems which are efficient, how could that be reviewed backwards and not impact the viability of the farming system, both in relation to land and the efficient application of water to land? Presumably the two are geared or correlated considerations, is the first question.
Yes, they are correlated.
They are correlated. And so if I am efficiently using or applying water to the requisite area of land, how could you take water, how could you diminish either the rate of take or the volume without excluding land under irrigation? That would, one would follow from the other, wouldn't it?
I think they would have, the only way you could do it would be to exclude land or to reduce the amount of time each area of land was being irrigated if you were to claw back volume or rate.
Right. And then you'd get into questions of viability where the irrigation system is, where investment has been made in an irrigation system, assuming certain parameters as to efficiency and efficiency relative to the total area to be irrigated.
Yes, there may be in part. It probably depends on the system set up on each property. For example, one large pivot on the property and that was it. It'd be significantly more impacted by that than a property that had a K-line systems where it's just as easy not to run a K-line out over one area than not. So it's more those bigger systems and whether the whether a property just has one or has multiple or could... I mean, I'm not an irrigation specialist to know how you'd change it, really, so...
Mm. So for relatively inefficient systems such as guns and K-line, and putting, you agree that guns and K-lines are not as efficient as laterals and other spray irrigation systems?
I couldn't recall the exact figures, but they're still far more efficient than... than flood and board.
Well, I'm only
systems,
focusing on those
on
because
spray.
I know I can shift a K-line. And
yes,
in theory, you could shift a gun relatively easy as well. Yeah. So for those systems where there's no fixed infrastructure, if I could put it that way, related to the land, you could remove the systems, not irrigate the land. Don't know whether a farmer would think that's viable or not. Depends on whether they've planted cherries, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's very dependent on what the system is that they've got and how much of an area it changed. I don't think it's as easy as saying it's not going to make a property viable or it will always still allow it to be.
No.
So it is a case by case.
Quite a degree of uncertainty if you have to go to a case by case assessment of the impacts of a future land and water plan.
Yes.
And how those might be rolled through, if you like, in terms of the consents that replacement consents that are under consideration today. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Deem permits. I know you're not involved, but you said you had a thought yesterday. So what was your thought?
Oh, my thought.
All
was
thoughts
just,
welcome.
Was just with regards to how that one item of priorities might be covered.
Yeah.
And the only thoughts I had is that it probably just has to fall into the matter of discretion or matter of control,
right,
whereby it's effectively an existing aspect or existing conditions on some of those deemed permits, but an evaluation in the application phase would be required, whereby maybe it's just set out and in the application form. I don't know exactly, but you know, an applicant would have to identify firstly, if there is any priorities attached to their deemed permit.
Mm.
Secondly, do they exercise them? And thirdly, the only time it really matters, I think, is if the lower priority is higher in the catchment.
Mm.
So it doesn't really matter if the person at the top of the catchment has highest priority.
No.
It doesn't make any difference.
Get
so
the money,
there's three
not
components.
The money, the water. Yep.
And so I don't think you'd get every priority that exists rolling over. And I think I was looking through Ms. Dicey's supplementary and she'd put, you know, inserted a couple of the tables that are the way they're currently worded.
Mm.
And I think obviously there's a legal component that then comes from that, but I think the need for that is so that there is effectively something in writing that holds the line for those priorities in terms of particularly between applicants knowing that that exists, because obviously those sections of the Act state that, you know, they don't continue beyond 1 October.
Yeah.
So those sections of the Act don't apply then, and so it's just having some formal record of those for the future conversations for water sharing regimes as they might apply under the Land and Water Plan. That's my only thought.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I had a similar thought, you know, could it be a matter of control or a matter of discretion under an RDA? I wasn't sure. I mean, and this is assuming that you can and should bring it down, that there's some good reason for doing it. So I wasn't sure. And then I think I was asking Ms. Dicey maybe there needed to be a policy signal. And I think she said maybe. And Ms. Irving put quite well, you know, retooling existing policy. So I thought, you know, that maybe we should look at that. Could we look at that? Do we need to even? And, of course, that might be a 293 matter, unless there's scope. Certainly scope in some, there may be some scope in some submissions.
I think there's potentially scope because it's a kind of like an existing condition, and we've always talked about existing conditions coming through. So it's just a legal matter of whether that's a condition or not.
It's a creature. I think it's probably a creature statute, but I have to talk to all of the lawyers about that. You said, you know, subject to whether they've ever exercised them. How would you ever know? And the fact that I might need to do it this year but not need to do it for another decade, that actually might be the case.
Yes.
But it's important.
I think really my view of it is that if they haven't exercised it historically, it goes, because everyone was assuming it would go under a new full replacement anyway. Mm. But it is relying on the word of the applicant in the application. So, yeah, that's I couldn't give you any more help because I don't think any historic use records can demonstrate, because the flows vary timing-wise, whether you're taking it or the natural flows are lower. So there's nothing to tell you in a water use record if they've been exercised as a proof kind of component.
Is there any value in this, in the record of priorities, either all of the priorities or just, you know, the ones that you want to capture, priorities which are not header catchment, but I guess a mid-catchment, lower catchment, not quite sure where you draw the line there. But is there any use in that as a method sitting outside of the plan, as in, you know, this is the record that parties might have reference to going forward in terms of forming water management groups, and saying that I suspect they all know darn well who's got what?
The only way you can do it is to go look at every single deem permit and pull out the priorities that are listed on them. I mean, they're all there.
Mm.
It just would require someone to spend a few days doing an administrative task.
Not me. Now some easy questions, hopefully. And if you don't know, just say so, because you've only been working on Otago 2 to 3 years. For those catchments, so this is the questions that I asked in the minute. Broader questions. For those catchments which are outside your Schedule 2A areas and deemed permits have already been replaced under the RMA, I asked, is the new water permit subject to a right of priority? Do you know?
The ones I have dealt with, no.
Okay, no. Allocation limit and minimum flow?
Yes. Not an allocation limit, sorry. The allocation hasn't changed from the current allocation limit under the RPW, which is anything prior to 1998 is the primary allocation limit.
So that's policy 642?
Yeah, so that hasn't changed, but there is minimum or residual flows.
So it's minimum or residual flow cessation conditions?
Well, they're effectively from a residual flow cut off,
For those replacement permits, are there any other type of conditions that we should know about that are regulating availability of water flow within a water body as between abstractors? So here we're talking about abstractors, not the environment.
Yes.
What else?
I wasn't the planner preparing the Luggett catchment ones, but I have just recently been helping the Luggett group prepare their low flow rationing agreement, which is a condition of their consents. And that effectively, the five matters identified that form that agreement are a communications protocol amongst themselves, how they will give priority to domestic users, what are the triggers levels for when they will start reductions, what is their agreed abstraction reduction methodology, so whether they go one-to-one with each other, alternate days, and then the process they will use to notify OIC when they start those reductions.
Are you conditions of consent that relate to that?
So that's a lot, the consent condition requires a low flow rationing agreement. Those are the five components of that agreement. And all of the consents have a minimum flow for the irrigation season and outside the irrigation season for primary takes. and then they also have two supplementary limits, a first supplementary band and a second supplementary band, and residual flows below their individual points of take.
So that's a 2019 decision, is it?
Yes, or possibly 2020. Can't remember exactly when it was. I've just been helping with the, trying to start drafting that agreement for them, or with them.
Okay. For catchments inside of Schedule 2A, have the minimum and allocation limits been applied to existing permit holders on review? So there's a review now done.
Not that I've been involved in or aware of.
Okay.
The only one is that Luggett hearing, there was a, I wasn't involved in it, but looking at it now, there was a 2A limit, and that was part of the conversations at the hearing, but I couldn't give you any more detail on that.
Was Luggett a replacement or a review?
Replacement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, for catchments inside 2A, where deemed permits have been now replaced under the RMA, are those permits subject to a right of priority?
I haven't been involved with any.
You haven't been involved with
any 2A catchment
replacement
ones.
2As. No. Okay. All right.
Not that have got to the point of replacement.
Not. So there's no sort of singles.
No, the, I mean, the last chance
you know, the
one
odd,
that I was dealt with
out there.
Is the tributaries of the,
yeah.
of the of Lakes Roxburgh and the Clutha, and then other ones that I've been involved with, applications in process. That's the only one granted so far.
Okay. So they're my questions. No questions. And again, your opportunity, do you want to add anything to any questions that the court has asked?
No.
Or anything arising, counsel, from the court's questions? No, nothing. And do you want to add anything?
No.
In terms of anything we've just put to you?
I think I've covered any little note that I'd made. So.
Very good. All right. Sounds like we might see you back again, but you know, by the time we've finished the JWS exercise. So thank you very much. Again, it's been very helpful. All right. Where to? TAs. Okay.
So I'll start with opening.
Oh, yes.
It's kind of momentous. To be
now, I need a new copy of that.
Yes, now I've got copies
yep,
here.
Thank you.
Just before I start on the submissions, just as a flag for you, I'm just tweaking the order of the witnesses slightly, just to accommodate some availability now that we're a bit later in the day than planned on the schedule. So I'll call Mr. Heller, followed by Mr. Toos, and then Ms. Muir and Ms. McGurr. The order of those two might just depend on the afternoon and whether we think it's just easier to bring Ms. Muir back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll just keep that in mind during the rest of
okay.
the day.
Thank you.
All right. So, as I think we've heard a number of times now, Plan Change 7 has been described as a process or interim framework devised to address the gap between the replacement of deemed permits and other water permits expiring prior to 2025 and the notification of the Otago Regional Council's new NPS-compliant land and freshwater management regime. The primary mechanism for achieving this is a consent duration of 6 years for all new and replacement water permits, regardless of the purpose for which the water is intended to be used. Unfortunately, this term limitation creates a significant issue for the territorial authorities that are required to maintain and develop community water supplies. In addition to being a second-tier priority within Te Mana o Te Wai, provision of safe and secure supplies of drinking water is legislatively mandated through the Local Government Act 2002, and the territorial authorities also have obligations regarding water supplies pursuant to the Health Act 1956 and the Civil Defence Emergency Act 2002. As set out in the evidence on behalf of the TAs, provisions of these services necessitates long-term planning, both from a financial point of view and due to the nature of the infrastructure. As such, it is not amenable to short-term water permits. Requiring councils to develop infrastructure without the certainty of long-term access to water puts them in an enviable position with respect to their obligations to ensure prudent stewardship, efficient and effective use of resources, including planning effectively for future management of those resources. Plan Change 7 captures a small number of existing community supplies and will also impact on planned developments for new or upgraded supplies. It is the position of the TAs that in doing so, Plan Change 7 fails to address the mandatory obligations of both the TAs themselves and of the Otago Regional Council. Including community water supply within the ambit of Plan Change 7 prevents both the TAs and the ORC from satisfying their obligations under the partially operative regional policy statement, the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, and the National Policy Statement for Urban Development, and the Resource Management Act itself. In addition, the six-year term for all new and replacement permits will inhibit the TAs from fulfilling their community water supply obligations under the Local Government Act and the Health Act. By jeopardising the TAs' ability to manage and provide efficient and effective community supplies now and in the future. It remains the position of the TAs that Plan Change 7 should not apply to community supplies. Alternatively, if it is to apply, a number of key issues need to be addressed. Firstly, the amendment of Schedule 10A so that it is more appropriately calculating historic use for community supplies. Provision made for replacement permits for community supply to include increased rates and volumes to account for projected growth. And provision made for new permits to be sought where greater rates and volumes are required than under existing permits or where new community supplies are being developed. And finally, that consents for community supplies are able to be obtained for longer than 6 years. Now, in these submissions, I'm not traversing the sort of statutory analysis law, because you've heard that from a number of my other council, and I don't have a quarrel with their submissions in that regard. Mm-hmm. So I'm focusing on what we consider to be the key issues for the territorial authorities, and I set those out there at paragraph A to G, and we'll work through those one by one. Firstly, looking at community supplies in the context of the regional plan water, I think it's important to understand how these community supplies have been treated under the regional plan water. Community water supply has not been a defined term within the regional plan. The term town and community water supply is defined, although it is only utilised in the context of the Waitaki catchment. Town and community water supply means reticulated water supplies servicing urban areas, rural residential and residential subdivisions, including all commercial and industrial premises and schools and other educational facilities located within the reticulated area.
So can you pause there a second? So you've got town and community water supply, but it's only a term that applies to the Waitaki catchment?
It does.
Nowhere
yes.
else?
No, not so far as I could tell.
Are they special for a reason?
I think it was linked... Pardon?
They've got a special plan.
Special plan.
Yeah, it's linked to the fact the Waitaki, I think, allocation issues are dealt with essentially by Environment Canterbury under the Waitaki Water Allocation Plan. Yeah. So it does have its own sort of set of... its own special character in that sense.
Okay.
There's a few definitions that we work through. It's,
Okay, so that's Waitaki.
Respect. Yes.
Yeah, and I'll just reread that. Okay, so that's fine.
So we also got a definition for registered community drinking water supply, which is a drinking water supply which is registered under Section 69J of the Health Act and serves a community of more than 25 people for more than 60 days a year. Registered community drinking water supplies are afforded special status within the Regional Plan Water in recognition of their importance. For example, under Policy 642 capital A, such supplies may obtain more water than previously to account for growth.
Now, I'm not sure that that's correct. I think it is correct that there's no definition of community drinking water supply. Your planner certainly doesn't. Are you going to take us through to the what in fact is regarded as being of importance under the regional plan, because it's the under Chapter 5 dealing with drink water?
Well, Chapter 5 I think talks about the water supply values, which is a defined term and references water supplies for the existence of takes for human consumption, which have come to be relied on by the community. And it would be fair to say, as you work your way through the provisions or the various chapters, that there are a variety of terms
that are
used. And where I get to is, although that's a bit just disjointed, that a lot of those terms are essentially used in a synonymous fashion.
Well, you're going to have to get me over the line. You certainly didn't get me over the line for the Clutha decision, which you've appealed. And I don't know whether you've appealed that aspect of it, but I certainly wasn't over the line. So you're going to have to now take me over the line. Are your submissions dealing with Chapter 5?
No, they're not.
And is that problematic in terms of not bringing forward all relevant provisions to the court's attention?
Well, I think we've got to look at that, I suppose, in the context of this is a case about Plan Change 7 and whether or not community supplies need to be incorporated into that plan change.
What's the purpose of your submission on community water supply?
In terms of what it means?
Yes.
I'm just trying to set out for you what I think is the context under the Regional Plan Water about how that term is used.
But you're not going to take me to Chapter 5?
No.
No. And I know your planner doesn't as well, and we had questions for your planner. Why would you exclude something which appears to be relevant? That's problematic, or potentially problematic.
Sorry, so you mean why would we exclude community water supplies from Plan Change 7?
No,
Chapter 5 not being referred
to? Yes, that's right. If it is relevant, and it appears to be relevant because it's looking at the values associated, particularly pertaining to drinking water supply, why would you not put that relevant consideration before the court? Or why would you not say it is there, but we're excluding it for this reason? Why would you, and you know I know, because I've issued a decision on it, so now I'm expecting you to take me through that decision, or at least take me through to the parts that we've referenced in that decision as being relevant to this vexed question of community water supply. Because you know I know that they're there. And I was of the view then, still of the view now, they're relevant to an interpretation argument. Also, if you're arguing interpretation, how does one normally go about arguing interpretation? You set out what? In any interpretation argument, it's good practice to set out the statutory interpretation principles that you would rely on or that you consider relevant. Then having done so, apply those principles to the words and phrases which you say support, you know, wherever you're going, you know, your interpretation. But you haven't done that. And I will be looking at this with a view to what do the words say and what was the purpose and meaning. What's the meaning of the words if they're not clear? But what was the purpose in this subordinate piece of legislation? That is what we're meant to do, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So if that's what we're meant to do, why haven't you done it?
Well, I have to say I didn't
I didn't think that there was a question about the, I suppose, importance of community water supplies.
There is a question, is there not? There's no question about drinking water supplies, and the regional plan says they're important. That's to paraphrase Chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
The question in this whole proceeding is whether supply for dairy shed washdown, irrigation purposes or any other primary sector, potentially and potentially also maybe other urban uses, but certainly primary uses.
Mm.
That's what's in question, isn't it?
Yes, and I think in part, and I get to the question of drinking water and what that means further in the submissions, because I think that on first blush, it's very easy to say, well, drinking water is drinking water. Mm. It's the stuff we put in our mouths and swallow. But when we work our way through the definition of that the way that, I suppose, the evidence from the TAs on that issue, I don't think it is quite that simple.
No, because it could also be flushing toilets.
Absolutely.
Down at the local warehouse. Yes. Or it could be, you know, any other number of uses. And so in supporting an interpretation of community water supply and the range of uses, both for drinking water, for human consumption, as well as to be consumed before other residential and other purposes, you know, is it any range of drink of uses for water, which community water supply is to capture, or is it less than that? It's always been the matter and issue in this plan for community, for the TAs. Is that not so?
Well, I think that the TAs, I suppose, they know a community water supply when they see one.
Yeah.
In some ways. And so, you know, these are often systems that they have provided and had in place for very long periods of time. The question of, I suppose, divvying that up and deciding, well, how much of that is really community supply versus something else is perhaps not a level of inquiry that they undertake. And I think that also dovetails in part with their other statutory obligations and the scope they have for turning the tap off and on. And I do get into that in a reasonable level of detail in the submissions, because there are opportunities or risks of those things butting up against one another. Mm. And other methods, I suppose, through the likes of the Local Government Act and so on, that helps manage, I think, the dynamic you're interested in, which is how much of these supplies is not drinking water or community. It's these particularly rural uses that...
which have a commercial endpoint, then, yes. But then again, you could say so does the toilet at the local warehouse. So
yeah, and I think...
It's problematic.
Oh, it's
problematic.
Mixed.
And
I agree.
To be fair to you, any interpretation argument should be founded on statutory interpretation principles, which should be set out in your submissions, because all you will have the court do is for the court to do the work for you, but then to decide what interpretation principles apply and then apply them, and if you don't like the answer, you'll appeal. It's actually your responsibility to, you know, to set it out. And then for us to pick up the argument in those, with those principles being applied. I'll give you a chance to come back to this overnight.
Okay.
It is not just a matter of telling us, look at these principles, but it's these principles, how are they applied? But the issue, there are infrastructural issues, for, you know, I suspect, for the TAs, but there are also issues to do with the take and use of water for a wide range of purposes, which this regional council says needs to be held for a period of 6 years till it puts into effect a plan which is compliant with the NPS.
Mm.
Why is it wrong to do so?
Mm.
So this is, I don't doubt that you've got a hard, you've actually got a really hard case. In terms of, that doesn't mean to say you're not going to succeed. You've actually got a hard case in terms of trying to both meet, if you like, the needs of the TA and the regional council. They're both important. They yes. both have their statutory drivers. And they both do, is really the key message.
Yes.
Now, do you want to continue with your submissions or do you want to reflect on the law?
I think I would like to, I think, continue with the submissions. I can come back to you on, I suppose, a more detailed analysis of the interpretation issue around community supplies, if that's necessary. But I think
it will be necessary if you haven't given me the statutory principles that you rely on.
Certainly. Yep. Certainly. But I think the questions around the interrelationship between the other statutory obligations, the functions that both territorial authorities and the regional council have, I think we can carry on with that because I think, yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So what I might... so we're back at paragraph 15. Oh, well, I've read through paragraph 15, mm-hmm. so we'll start with 16. So in Schedule 1B and 3B, the regional plan identifies existing water takes that are used for public water supply purposes. And the schedule identifies that the communities supplied by these takes have come to rely on them for their social and economic and cultural well-being. And that links to the definition in the regional plan around water supply values, which is a term used in Chapter 5, as Your Honour has referred to.
And what is that? Let's now go into the plan, because I think it'd be helpful to actually track what you're saying through the plan itself.
Did you want to start with the definition of water supply values?
Yes, and the policy that comes with it.
So volume one of the common bundle. And the definition of water supply values is at common bundle page 447. Oh, is it? Sorry, my volume is combined. It's tab 2.
Is this in the definition section?
In the glossary, yes, which is actually perversely at the back.
Oh, here's the thing for memory.
In the
very last page of a very long plan. So, water supply values. Okay.
So the existence of a take for human consumption, which people and communities have come to depend on.
Okay, suppose there is a second, I just want to annotate your submissions. So, I've lost the thread. Water supply values, do you mention that at paragraph 16 or your...
No, I don't.
So water supply values is defined. And it means the existence of a take.
For human consumption. Which people and communities have come to depend on.
Second.
and you've referenced that because you know I know about it, or you've referenced that because it fits into an argument?
No, I was actually... I picked up on that when I was looking back at the glossary for another issue, actually, and noticed water supply value sitting there with a definition, which I thought was odd. And I hadn't picked it up when I was working my way through the plan in relation to the terms around community supply. And so the term water supply value is the one that is used in Chapter 5. And the use and development, so if we're looking at Chapter 5, it's picked up in 5.2.1 is in the issues. 5.2.1, which is the issues that the use and development of the water resources may have the potential to have adverse effects on water supply values. And then in policy 5.4, which is to identify the following natural and human use values supported by lakes and rivers, which is the policy that gives rise to the schedules. So in this case, Schedule 1B and 3B, which identifies the supplies for public water supply purposes.
So Schedule 1 and 3B, you say?
Yes.
But even by 3, what's in 3?
3B is the groundwater takes.
Only Schedule 1 is actually referred to here.
Yes, that's correct.
It's probably a matter of fact, but groundwater being utilised to supply drinking water for water for human consumption. Or don't you know?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
So at least Schedule 1, because Schedule 1 is actually all that's referred to. Okay, so so identify human use values in Schedule 1, and that includes human use values, including water supply values, which are the values for human consumption. That's to come in Schedule 1.
Yes.
All right.
And so Schedule 1B includes that list of existing what I referred to in the schedule as public water supplies.
Yeah.
But are primarily the water supplies operated by the territorial authorities.
Just pause there a second. So Schedule 1B is a schedule of water supply values, which water supply values is defined as being a take for human consumption.
Yeah, so if you look at Schedule 1B, which is Common Bundle page 352, we've got Schedule of Water Supply Values, and this schedule identifies the existing water takes from lakes and rivers where that water is taken and used for public water supply purposes. And the communities identified in the schedule have come to rely upon these water supplies to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being.
And so the interpretational question for you is whether water supply values, which is a defined term and it means human consumption, is used differently in this schedule. And
yes.
I didn't think necessarily that was the case, although it may well have been implemented by district councils that way, but the water supply values are those which are there for human consumption.
That's correct. Mm. And then when we look at the provisions around in Chapter 6, it's where we start to see a different terms used around the likes of the registered community drinking supply, community suppliers, mm. and so on. So there is a bit of a disconnect between Chapter 5 and the provisions in mm. Chapter 6.
And this is where your statutory interpretation, the principles established by case law,
mm.
become really important. Is there a gap between the two chapters? Any inconsistency between the two chapters, or can they actually be reconciled according to their purpose? That's all statutory interpretation mm. stuff, and that's where the law becomes really important. All right.
Okay.
Any other policies in Chapter 5? Because I know that they are. I'll give you a hint. It's policy 5.4.2. It's not in your planning evidence, but it's there.
Yeah.
So the management of any activity involving surface water, groundwater, bed or margin of any lake or river, to give priority to avoiding and preference to remedying or mitigating water supply values in Schedule 1B.
Yeah, adverse effects on the water supply values in 1B.
Mm.
So I interpret that to mean that other activities need to be managed to avoid effects on the water supply values rather than remedy or mitigate those effects.
Yeah, avoid and preference. It's yeah. quite a clear statutory direction.
Yeah.
But again, water supply values, is that for the purpose of the defined term, which is for human consumption, or something else?
Mm.
And this is where you start to get tension with TAs taking water for a whole host of activities, which in combination with land use
yes.
have the potential to impact drinking water.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so then how is... And that's the perversity, if you like, in terms of a take for a range of uses
yeah.
and then and how are we managing that or reconciling that under this plan.
Yes, and I think perhaps the issue that came up, I think, in the Clutha case that you are familiar with
mm.
Was the use of the water for the dairy shed washdown and so on, and whether or not the effects of that use would then affect the consumption or the human consumption values. Yeah. And I think the question then is that an effect of the use of water, or is that an effect of the discharge following the use of that water?
Or is it an effect of associated land uses? But
yes.
And how does the plan in any integrated sense deal yeah. with that? Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Clutha example is a like we so often find in this case. You know, that's a, certainly based on the evidence, a bit of an outlier in terms of the proportion of water that is utilised for other uses.
The planner needed to be saying this. I think your planner mm. needed to have been dealing head-on with Chapter 5, particularly in light of an adverse court decision only late last year,
mm.
and needed to be saying, Clutha, in that one take, is an outlier. Actually, everybody's pretty much primarily for human consumption, which I don't assume it means just drinking water. It can be meaning flushing a warehouse. But, you know, but needed to be dealing with that as opposed to present uncertainty. But we can follow mm. up, or you can follow up in questions with that.
Yes.
But your task is what are the water supply values which are there in that schedule? Is it for human consumption, or is it
and what does that mean? Or is it a range of other uses, including including the ones noted in which really the court was quite troubled about in Clutha?
Yeah, I can give more detailed thought to that particular issue.
Because I think it's all statutory interpretation, yes, to be fair. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we carry on?
Okay.
So the question of community supplies also comes up in Chapter 15,
mm-hmm.
Which is the chapter identifying the non-regulatory methods that may apply, and that is Common Bundle 262.
Just pause for a second.
And so the relevant provision is 15.2.1, which relates to the restrictions on taking water. So it seems to me that that is anticipating that the uses that aren't human consumption, or at least hosing restrictions.
So watering your garden.
Yes.
So here you're using human consumption. I had wondered whether human consumption means more than just drinking it. But
yes.
And again, looking forward to hearing from your planner on that, and also your submissions on that. But anyway, community supplies, how does that help us? Hosing restriction, I wasn't aware of that, but I mean, you kind of expect it. But
yes,
so ORC to talk to TAs,
yes,
when the consumption of water in a community supply. Okay, which is not a defined term.
No.
Okay.
So basically, yep, when, as a catchment comes under pressure,
mm,
and water users generally are beginning to experience shortages, the expectation will be that community supplies will also, I suppose, do their bit by dealing with what they're referring to as hosing restrictions. And this, I think, dovetails, as I say, with the other statutory frameworks that the TAs work with in relation to this around water conservation management plans and so on. And I think is a acknowledgement, perhaps, of the practical circumstances we're dealing with this infrastructure, where there are a range of activities and uses that water is put to within a single system, and that within that there will be some levers to pull to reduce consumption if that's necessary at particular points in time. But
is that limitation just one of watering? Hosing?
Well, I think
I mean, I'm assuming hosing means water in your, yes, parks and gardens.
Yes, and I think that's right of this liaison provision.
Of this particular provision,
correct,
it's just hosing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are other, as I say, mechanisms that the TAs work with that covers a broader range of issues, which I talk through later in the submissions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just, the purpose of that was to really try and pick up on the various terms that are used in the plan. And I think as you work through the plan, it is a little bit, it's probably generous, but disjointed.
Mm.
But that's what we're working with. So I think then I want to turn to what the TA's view is of what community water supplies encompass.
which is discussed in the evidence of Mr Greenwood, now Ms Muir, Mr Heller and Ms McGurr. And they talk about the existing community water supplies providing potable water for a range of purposes, including human consumption, commercial and industrial activities, and a small proportion of rural uses. The water is distributed via schemes that generally don't distinguish between these uses, and the TAs regulate the delivery of water within their community supply network according to other legislation, in particular the Local Government Act and the Health Act. And under the Local Government Act, it is common for the TAs to establish bylaws for this purpose. Now, other parties, particularly the Minister for the Environment, have suggested that it may be appropriate to provide a carve-out from Plan Change 7 for drinking water. And it appears from that evidence that drinking water is intended to be a narrower subset of water provided by community water supplies managed by the territorial authorities. Now, drinking water is a defined term under the National Planning Standards, meaning water intended to be used for human consumption and includes water intended to be used for food preparation, utensil washing, and oral or other personal hygiene. As Mr. Tu sets out in his supplementary evidence, drinking water has been consistently defined in the planning standards, the resource management environmental standards for sources of drinking water, and the drinking water standards for New Zealand 2005. Under Section 69G of the Health Act, drinking water is defined slightly differently. It is water that is potable but excludes stock water or irrigation water that does not enter a home or building for drinking, food, preparation or domestic use. Now, to understand the provision of drinking water by territorial authorities, it's useful to consider what they actually do. They abstract water from its source, convey it through infrastructure to a treatment plant, and treat it so that it may be made available for human consumption. TAs then distribute drinking water from their treatment plant through their networks to a point of supply on a connected property. All of that water is treated to a level intended for human consumption. It is submitted that whether the drinking water is actually consumed by people or used for sanitary purposes is not the determinative feature of drinking water. Concerns about other uses of potable water after it enters the distribution network misapprehends the intention and effect of treating water to a potable standard. The reason water is taken by TAs and treated is to make it fit for human consumption, food preparation and sanitation purposes. The definition reflects this by referring to water intended to be used for human consumption. Water taken for community supply becomes drinking water when it is treated and made potable and able to be safely consumed. It is submitted that this interpretation of the definition aligns with the reality of operating these schemes. It would not be practical to separate the provision of water that is actually consumed by humans from water delivered by the same system and used for other purposes. In fact, the TAs are not empowered to turn the tap off completely. And that was brought in by virtue of an amendment to the Health Act, where the territorial authorities' power to stop providing drinking water services was completely repealed. The Local Government Act 2002 provides a limited range of circumstances where water supply can be restricted, and those powers are subject to the TA's obligations pursuant to the Health Act.
Under the Health Act, the TAs are required to take all practicable steps to ensure that adequate supply of water is provided to every point of supply.
Just pause there a second.
And what I...
Need to read and absorb it, and I'll come back to you with any amplification. Yep, and what do you want to say?
I just wanted to, just missed a footnote there, but adequate supply is a defined term in the Health Act, meaning in relation to drinking water supplied to a property means either the minimum quantity of drinking water that is required by the occupants of that property on an ongoing basis for their ordinary domestic food preparation, use and sanitary needs, or... if there are regulations made that prescribes the quantity of drinking water or a formula for it, then whatever that quantity is.
Pause there a sec.
So the quid pro quo of being provided with water for water users is set out in the Local Government Act section 192, which obliges them to avoid wasting water. And TAs seek to manage this through the implementation of water conservation management plans that set out the methods to be adopted to ensure that water is used efficiently and the steps that will be taken if water supply shortages are experienced. And again, councils may establish bylaws for this purpose. In my submission, that this is, means there's a degree of overlap between the TA's Local Government Act obligations and their obligations under the Resource Management Act. In section 14, subsection 1H, territorial, and this is under the Local Government Act, territorial authorities must act in accordance with the principle of sustainable development, including taking into account the social, economic and cultural well-being of people and communities, the need to maintain and enhance the quality of the environment, and the reasonably foreseeable needs of future generations. So their obligations and the purpose under the Local Government Act directly reflects the purpose under the Resource Management Act. The two things need to mesh together in order to allow territorial authorities to carry out all of their functions. And I just note there the proposed definition of community water supply that was included in the outcome of the planner's joint witness statement. The proposed definition, I think, picks up the key aspects of water supply, including the TA's obligations under the Health and Local Government Acts, and the fact that the schemes provide drinking water for a range of uses, not just human consumption.
Yes, and that's the thing that you're going to have to grapple with. I mean, I understand the infrastructure, at least from the Clutha case. I had that in mind, and you reflect that back in your submissions, that the TAs are treating all water to a human consumption standard, and that's fine. The fact that you deliver it to a mechanical workshop is neither here nor there. It's treated to that standard. But that's not, that is not the issue that we're dealing with here. The fact that they have to treat it to a certain standard does not mean, therefore, is that to confuse the I'm sorry, I'm not sure where you, I haven't quite pinned where you're going with the statutory interpretation. Are you interpreting the something, either the regional plan or PC7, you want an outcome on PC7, by making equivalent the treatment standard of water to the purpose for which water is supplied or the value of the water in terms of the operative plan definition? Now you're losing me, because the treatment standard is not equivalent.
So this is, I think, I mean, I keep saying it, this is all very hard, but...
It is, to be fair. You've actually got one of the harder cases.
Yeah, I think it is hard.
Because your clients are actually supplying for a full range of uses, which this regional council says maybe drink water, human consumption excluded, but, hey, why are you continuing to supply, and the good example is dairy shed, when we've got PC7 sitting there?
I think...
PC8 sitting there.
Yes. I think that... the key, I suppose, feature for me was in the definition of drinking water. And what is drinking water? And it's not just water that is consumed. It is the water intended for consumption. So when I look at the way that councils operate their water supply infrastructure... It is drinking water when it has been treated and it's ready for that purpose. Whether it actually goes out into the network and is used for that purpose, I don't think matters in terms of whether or not the whole take, I suppose, should be captured by Plan Change 7. I think that there are the other mechanisms that the territorial authorities use through the Local Government Act and the Health Act and so on, that manages the, I suppose, the demand side when there are restrictions or issues around the availability of that supply. But that the significance of water supply being available to the community is such that we shouldn't be, shutting the gate on those wider range of uses prior to, the treatment plant.
So, again, that's a statutory interpretation approach, both statute as well as the regional plan. It has to be founded on statutory interpretation principles which apply to the argument that you're running, including potentially provisions within legislation and provisions within PC7 and the operative plan, which in some way are inconsistent. It would require a finding of inconsistency or not, and trying, and always with a view to interpreting or smoothing out any inconsistencies, such that the purpose of the provisions that you are relying on can stand according to their purpose. It's all statutory interpretation. You're not there. Well, your proposition is, as I understand it, that if a TA treats water to a standard which is fit for human consumption, the purpose of its use is irrelevant, if it is completely irrelevant. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's right.
With that in mind, you need to go back and now, with that principle in mind, the use of the water which has been treated to a standard for human consumption is irrelevant, you now need to land that potentially both in your TA type, you know, LGA, Health Act, blah, blah, blah. You know, that and the Resource Management Act itself, just to iron out or see whether or not there's any inconsistencies in provisions. And then you also need to do that, I think, within the regional plan itself and PC7. But is that your key proposition, provided that the TAs treat water to a standard which is fit for human consumption, its use is irrelevant?
Yes.
All right. Now I understand the key proposition. You've got some work.
I'm not linking.
You've got some work. Yeah. And do you appreciate why I'm saying there's some work here?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. No, I understand the issue.
Okay, good. All right.
Right. So, turning to the territorial authorities' obligations to provide water infrastructure. So, under the Local Government Act and the Health Act, the TAs are tasked with providing safe drinking water, maintaining that existing water supply infrastructure, protecting water supply as a lifeline utility, anticipating the future demand for water supply, and planning for future growth and capacity. The TAs must develop long-term plans to satisfy these statutory objectives. Under the Local Government Act 2002, Section 93 requires the territorial authorities to have a long-term plan, which identifies the work they will do over at least 10 years and the funding required for that work. In the LTP, the TAs will set out how they will achieve identified community outcomes and at what cost. Generally, 25 to 35% of the TA's LTP expenditure relates to three waters infrastructure. So that's stormwater, water supply, and sewage infrastructure. A TA must ensure prudent stewardship and efficient and effective use of resources in the interests of its district. And planning effectively for the future management of assets is specifically recognised as part of this duty. It is not one the TAs can abrogate responsibility for. The TAs must also, as part of the LTP process, prepare an infrastructure strategy identifying how community water supply infrastructure will be managed for at least 30 years. The strategy must include indicative estimates of expenditure for the first 10 years of the strategy and for each subsequent five-year period following that. To provide projections like this, the TAs must canvass scenarios about the levels of service, life cycle of assets, and the level of certainty in the assumptions underpinning the canvass scenarios. It is submitted that the six-year term in Plan Change 7 is at considerable odds with the long-term planning horizons that territorial authorities must operate to under the Local Government Act. Turning to the Health Act, drinking water is governed by Part 2A of the Health Act, and the purpose of this is to protect the health and safety of people and communities by promoting adequate supplies of safe and wholesome drinking water from all drinking water supplies. The public health obligations on TAs with respect to water supply are significant. As drinking water suppliers, TAs must take all reasonable steps to protect the source of their water supply and that in all respects the drinking water supply system is free from contamination. They must have a water safety plan, which is reviewed every 5 years with respect to their network. In addition, they must monitor the supply and ensure it complies with the drinking water standards. The standards divide the drinking water supply system into its source, the treatment plant, and the distribution zone. This encourages management and planning to be structured across these three areas. Compliance with these obligations is supported by the territorial authorities' work programs through their infrastructure strategy and long-term plan. Turning to the regional council and the TA's respective functions under the RMA,
Those are obviously set out under Section 30 and 31. And the ORC and the TAs have some shared obligations with respect to integrated management and to ensure sufficient development capacity. Starting with development capacity, in response to current housing shortages, an obligation to ensure sufficient development capacity has been placed upon both the Otago Regional Council and the territorial authorities. Development capacity in sections 30 and 31 has the same meaning as in the NPS for urban development and therefore includes network infrastructure for water supply. It is submitted that limiting community water supply permits to 6 years and not enabling the provision for growth is likely to compromise the ability for sufficient development capacity to be provided, particularly in the medium term, being 3 to 10 years, as it will inhibit investment, long-term planning and development.
Just pause for a second. So what is the meaning of development capacity in that you've got a paragraph 48? Is that a defined term somewhere?
Yes, it is. It's in the National Policy Statement for Urban Development, which is in the Common Bundle at tab 6. Page CB787.
And I'll just read that for myself.
Certainly.
So development capacity in the NPS for Urban Development 2020 has two components. It's the capacity of land for to be developed for housing or business use, and it's based on zoning and adequate development of infrastructure to support the development of housing and business use. And my question for you is, housing defined?
Nope.
What about business use, or is business, the meaning of business use referable from the definition of business land?
There's no definition of business use.
And what about business? Yeah, but can that be? Is the meaning to be ascertained from business land? Business use.
Yes,
on business
I think
land?
That would be right.
Yep. Okay.
So land zoned for those purposes.
And it's in an urban environment.
Correct.
And so this submission, and again, bearing in mind we're dealing with rural TAs as well as urban TAs, well, I suppose they will have an element of urban, is this submission focused on urban environments, or is it focused on rural and urban environments?
Well, I think it has to cover both.
It's that statutory interpretation, so why are we now looking at the rural environment?
Well, I think there's the council's obligation to provide the infrastructure applies to not just its urban environments. This
submission is in relation to the council's functions in relation to development capacity. So to that extent, it will apply where we are dealing with an urban environment as it's defined. So that is limited, but the point is that the TAs will provide water infrastructure to communities that may not qualify as urban environments under the MPSUD. So this is part of the equation, not the complete equation.
This is statutory. This is, again, statutory, because I read this, and I think you are correct insofar as TAs have to provide water for housing.
Yes.
And that could be urban or rural. It doesn't really matter where its location is. But business starts to bite in terms of where its location is. Or do you say that's wrong?
Well, I think that So I think we've got to go back to 1.3 of the MPS around the application of the policy statement, which is to apply to urban environments.
I haven't got it printed. Okay.
So have you got Common Bundle 786?
No, and I seem to be missing 786. I'm reading
786.
Okay, so 1.3.
Yes.
And there's a definition of
urban environment. Yes, that's right. So I think in terms of the application of the MPSUD, that is going to apply to those urban environments as defined. And so the submission in relation to the functions for development capacity are linked to that. So it doesn't extend to the communities that the council may provide drinking water or water supply to that are outside an urban environment.
So I've annotated your submission by the adjacent to the subtitle development capacity at page 9 to say this submission is limited to urban environment.
Yes.
Okay.
So I think, and I think the issue of providing infrastructure, development infrastructure, will be to housing and business land within urban environments.
Right.
So the submission is that impeding the planning and development for network infrastructure for water supply by truncating the term and scale of community supply permits is contrary to the regional council's obligations under section 31BA and potentially places the territorial authorities in the position of being unable to satisfy their development capacity obligations under section 31(1)(AA).
Where are you reading from?
This is my submission.
Okay, sorry. I didn't. Yeah. Did you read paragraph 49? I might have had my nose stuck in an MPS when you were...
Yes, I did.
Okay. Did you say 3 to 10 years?
Well, it was... So that's the medium term time horizon within the MPS. And the six-year term under Plan Change 7 sort of fits in the time frame that the territorial authorities will be planning their infrastructure or implementing infrastructure upgrades to provide development infrastructure in that particularly 3 to 10 year medium term window. So because of the way that the MPS for urban development anticipates that councils will try and get ahead of housing demand, business land, and have the infrastructure ready, the reality is they need to be moving, say, now, to put in place water supply infrastructure to provide that development capacity in that 3 to 10 year window.
So I found the definite, there is a definition of medium term, and it is, as you say, 3 to 10 years in the NPS for urban development.
Yes.
And six is sort of halfway there. And so what is your submission in that regard? Are you saying that if it were 10 years, at least that would dovetail with the medium term, or the, you know, the full extent of the medium term?
So what you'll hear in the, or you'll probably read in the evidence from the territorial authorities is that, and particularly within central Otago, there are works planned like in the next year to 2 years to improve water supply infrastructure and to anticipate the growth that they have seen or are seeing. And their evidence is that because of their other obligations around prudently managing their infrastructure and so on, a six-year renewal for those permits is going to present some significant challenges for them in terms of whether to push ahead with that work and run the gauntlet on whether or not those consents get renewed in 6 years' time, or whether they have to push pause on those projects to await the outcome of the subsequent renewal.
Yeah. And so again,
and then that puts them in a position where they are behind on providing their development infrastructure under the NPSUD.
So the uncertainty again is not so much Plan Change 7, but it's the plan to come, and any changes in the plan to come, which is, you know, the plan which is fully compliant with the NPS for fresh water.
In some respects, yes.
In all respects, is that not where your uncertainty goes?
Well, I think the one of the primary reasons that Mr. De Pelsmaker gave for preferring a six-year term rather than longer terms and then relying on review was his view that the council needed to be able to essentially refuse consent. So the territorial authorities have to operate on a basis where at the end of that six-year period they may not get a consent back.
Now, if the consent is for water, which use is human consumption, how likely do you think that is, well, given what the RMA also has to say about human consumption?
Yeah, and I think that's a good question. You would assume, or you could assume, that it's really unlikely that the regional council would want to refuse a consent for community supplies or drinking water.
Well, I'm actually being very specific here. I'm here actually saying whether taken use is actually for human consumption. So,
that's my opposition. I think it's right. So it's unlikely. So my question in relation to that, if it is that unlikely, why not grant a longer-term consent? And if there needs to be a review in order to implement a minimum flow, then that could be done. We know that with the territorial authorities, we're dealing with a relatively small number of permits, and the infrastructure is of such importance to these communities that I don't think, or my submission is, that the term of the consent should be shortened. Because, as you say, why would the regional council want to refuse a renewal of that application? But if the term is critical, and that's what the TAs are telling you, to their ability to invest in the infrastructure in the interim and to deliver on their long-term planning obligations, then let's give them the time to do that.
Probably two responses to that. Firstly, it does rather depend on the use for which water is put to, and your submission is the use is irrelevant. Provided TAs treat to a drink water standard, that is all that's relevant. So maybe the regional council is rightly concerned as to the use in an integrated sense, because that's what's coming, land and water. It is concerned about the use to which water may be put. So that might be room for movement for your client. If the take and use is for human consumption, then maybe there's less of a concern. but maybe there is quite considerable concern if the use to which the TAs may put the water is irrelevant, none of the regional council's concern.
Mm.
That's quite a different proposition.
Yeah.
And I'm going to leave it there.
Yeah.
You think about it over lunch. You think about it over lunch, but I think you've just confirmed, yes, your problem is not with this plan. Your problem was that the consenting environment might change under the Land and Water Plan. And so what you're doing is trying to manage your risk by obtaining long-term consents.
Yes.
Where use is taken away, effectively removed from the regional council under your argument.
Sorry, can you
repeat
that?
Where the use of water is effectively removed from the purview of this regional council. Its oversight, its regulatory oversight and its obligations.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
Well, you've said to me that the use of water is irrelevant. And I would have thought, yeah, that's a statutory interpretation matter because I think this regional council's got statutory obligations there.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and there's a few parts to that question.
Yeah, there is a few parts. But there's also, if you're going to grasp the nettle, surely it is actually agreeing, it's to recognise that both take and use are matters in relation to which the regional council itself has statutory obligations. Both are relevant. Treating to a drink water standard and use for human consumption means whatever it means. Might be a way through this, but it just seems, yeah. Anyway, okay.
You're